ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, and welcome back to this year's Boyer Lectures on ABC Radio National. The Boyer Lectures began way back in 1961 and were named after the ABC's very first chair, Sir Richard Boyer, a true champion of an independent public broadcaster in Australia. This second Boyer lecture in the series of five is presented by John Anderson, farmer, grazier and former Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the National Party, who's also now one of this country's most popular podcasters on YouTube, with more than 760,000 followers at last count. In this lecture, John will argue that our country is on the precipice of what he calls a civilizational moment in history, where the liberal world order that has thus far defined our age now potentially coming to an end. And he believes that it's now up to us to decide whether we stagnate or rejuvenate with civility, responsibility, and open debate. Welcome to John Anderson.
I very much appreciate the ABC giving me the opportunity to make this speech, which I've titled Our Civilizational Moment. The English-American author Os Guinness speaks of civilizational moments, the point every civilization reaches where they begin to stagnate. They must either rediscover and rejuvenate the ideals and virtues that made them flourish, replace those ideals and virtues with equally effective ones, or decline and die off. The Western democratic world now stands at one of those moments. Since 1945, when an exhausted and sobered but triumphant alliance of democracies emerged from the horrors of the Second World War and the Holocaust, we have known what has often been called the liberal global order. The architects of the post-war settlement committed themselves with almost sacred resolve to construct a world where such horrors could not recur. For all its failings, that post-1945 liberal global order, led by America, delivered unprecedented peace and prosperity. The fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union's subsequent disintegration appeared to ratify everything the West had championed. Liberal democracy and market economics had not merely survived ideological competition, they had triumphed absolutely. History itself proclaimed some of our most confident voices had reached its terminus in favour of Western democracy. But today, democracy is in retreat. The evidence is stark and undeniable. Freedom House recorded a 19th straight year of global freedom decline in 2024, with political rights and civil liberties deteriorating in 60 countries while improving in only 34. Election-related violence occurred in 27 of the 66 countries that held national votes. The Economist Intelligence Unit puts the 2024 global democracy score at its lowest level since the index began in 2006, with only about 45% of people living in some form of democracy and 39% living under authoritarian rule. The liberal global order that has defined our age is coming to an end. And it is not only because of external threats, but also because of our own neglect. We have been complicit in the rise of our opponents through reactive short-term policy and a loss of belief in ourselves. Despite being amongst the wealthiest societies the world has ever seen, we've answered the cost of living crisis with policies that promise relief today while sending utterly unconscionable bills to our children and grandchildren. Culturally, we've insisted on emphasising the things that divide us rather than unite us, weakening our social compact and leaving us vulnerable to adversaries of great conviction. Authoritarian powers have seen our self-doubt as an opportunity, and they are exploiting it with glee. New York Times columnist David Brooks saw this clearly when he warned, "We don't only have to worry about the people tearing down democracy, we have to worry about who is building it up." The 21st century, Brooks writes, has become a dark century because the seedbeds of democracy have been neglected. For democracy to function, you have to till and fertilise the soil, erect fences, pull up weeds, prune the early growth. It takes a lot of cultivation to make democracy work. This is a global reckoning, and Australia cannot escape it. What happens to us is inextricably linked to what happens to the global democratic order. So let's take a closer look at our Australian democracy. Sir Robert Menzies, our longest-serving Prime Minister, said, "Of us Australian people, it will be written, they were born Democrats, as Democrats they died." He said this in the middle of the Second World War. And even though democracy's future in Europe was in serious doubt, its future in Australia, for Menzies at least, remained certain. Menzies was not the first to say that democracy and Australian identity were inextricably linked. After visiting Sydney in the 1820s, Edward Gibbon Wakefield wrote in 1829 that the democratic spirit will surely exist here. Within three decades, the three largest colonies, South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales, had adopted near-universal male suffrage for their lower houses. Because these franchises applied to male British subjects, Aboriginal men were in law eligible to vote, though participation was admittedly low. It was an imperfect but meaningful expansion of the franchise in the mid-19th century. In 1894, women in South Australia won the right to vote and stand for Parliament. And in 1902, the Commonwealth extended both rights to federal elections, making Australia only the second country to legislate national women's suffrage. Our democracy remained imperfect. That same year, the Commonwealth Franchise Act explicitly excluded Aboriginal Australians from the federal roll, except those already enrolled to vote in a state. Yet even so, by global standards, we were among the most democratic polities of the time. 80 years on from his prediction, Wakefield had been proved right. Another 120 years later, how fares Australian democracy today? By conventional metrics, perhaps quite well. The Economist's latest democracy index places Australia 11th among 167 nations. And yet, as Menzies warned in his broadcast essays of 1942, we must distinguish between the machinery of democracy and its spirit. Our electoral processes and the structure of our government are the machinery of our democracy, visible, measurable mechanisms we can audit and fine-tune. But as Menzies argued, it is the spirit of democracy, though more elusive and resistant to measurement, which forms its vital essence. Australia's democratic machinery continues to function, but how is its spirit faring? Well, trust surely sits at the heart of healthy democratic spirit. It is the precondition for cooperation and for recognising the interests we hold in common and in taking them forward. Low trust democracies do not long prosper. It is therefore deeply concerning that levels of trust in our key democratic institutions are at a historic low. In the Scanlon Institute's most recent national survey, only 33% of Australians trust the federal government all or most of the time. That's down 7% from when the survey was first conducted in 2007. The figure is 34% for state governments. That means that two-thirds of Australians don't trust their legislators most of the time. Perhaps a natural consequence of all this is that other than participating when they must in compulsory voting, younger Australians seem to be disengaging from politics, particularly millennials in their 30s and 40s. Distrust and disengagement are recent companions to our long-standing national vice, and perhaps the gravest threat to our democratic spirit, complacency. This vice seems as quintessentially Australian as the virtues we cherish. Our rejection of hierarchy, our easygoing irreverence, our refusal to take ourselves too seriously. Perhaps complacency is the inevitable shadow those virtues cast, the lurking danger within our national strength. We think of ourselves as the lucky country, having long forgotten that Donald Horne meant it as a warning, not a boast. We are largely uninterested in the careful thought, planning and sacrifice that created our political, economic and legislative institutions. The depth of thought and care that animated the Federation debates and conventions of the 1890s, ultimately producing our Constitution, is astonishing. Yet most Australians would have only the vaguest notion of who Henry Parkes, Edmund Barton, or Alfred Deakin were. It's as though our peace and prosperity simply fell from the sky, and we no longer respect, let alone emulate, the giants on whose shoulders we stand. Our perceived luck gives us a false sense of security, as though no matter what changes take place in the world, no matter what challenges arise nationally and internationally, she'll be right, mate. But history tells a very different story of the rise and fall of nations and civilizations. Luck runs out. Take our national defence. She'll be right seems to have become our national defence policy. Despite pleas from a unity ticket of our leading defence strategists and our most powerful ally, the United States, we still refuse to lift defence spending to even 3% of GDP. All the while, our government tells us that we are living in the most dangerous time since World War II. The contrast between Australia's attitude to defence today and the years leading up to the Great War could not be greater. Under legislation introduced in 1909 by Alfred Deakin and passed in 1911 under the Fisher Labor government, compulsory military training for Australian males from age 12 to 26 became part of Australian life. In 1909 and 1910, we placed orders with British shipyards for a battle cruiser with supporting light cruisers and destroyers and two E-class submarines, building an Australian Navy powerful enough to secure our homeland from the formidable German East Asia Squadron. Significantly, historian Geoffrey Blainey points out that left-wing as well as right-wing politicians strongly supported this emphasis on an armed Australia. Compare that with the situation today. Amazingly, we have no resources to minesweep our ports to protect our shipping as a trading island nation from enemy mines. Similarly, we have no ballistic missile defence, no way of shooting down missiles targeting Australia's critical infrastructure, let alone our population. All of these capabilities have been cut from our national defence budget. Our current onshore fuel reserves in a time of crisis would last only around 3 weeks. Beyond that, we would struggle to keep the country fed and moving, to produce and deliver vital goods to Australians in a time of emergency or war. How could we go to America with a straight face, asking for military aid, asking Americans to potentially sacrifice their sons and daughters and their gold for us, we who barely take our own defence seriously? Housing has been another area of decades-long public policy complacency. In an essay titled Welcome to the End of Democracy, American demographer Joel Kotkin singles out Australia in particular for once being uniquely egalitarian in terms of home and land ownership. But now, Kotkin reports, things have changed. Australia is returning to the old world of home ownership as a privilege of the wealthy. Home ownership is part of the egalitarian uniqueness of Australia, as opposed to Europe of the 18th and 19th centuries, where most land was locked up amongst wealthy elites. There was no greater testimony of Australian equality than the fact that convicts were given a minimum of 30 acres of land upon emancipation. The decline in home ownership is particularly apparent among young people, interestingly, perhaps, mirroring their political disengagement. For those aged 25 to 34, home ownership has decreased from 61% in 1981 to 43% at the time of our last national census in 2021. It'd be comforting for we older Australians to attribute this to a generational penchant for gap years and smashed avocado breakfasts. But in truth, it is a dangerous public policy failure. There have been other Canary in the Coal Mine episodes in recent years, episodes that revealed our deep complacency and failure to grasp the stakes of our current moment within the broader sweep of history. One was our collective failure to reckon with the new economic reality following the global financial crisis and to make the short-term sacrifices needed to reduce the national debt burden borne by future generations. This was particularly evident in the collapse of the 2014 federal budget's attempt at meaningful structural reform. Since then, there's been no serious constituency for sound economic management in this country. Plainly, we are at risk of baking in the decline in our living standards that we are now witnessing. I genuinely fear that we are in structural decline. I'm staggered by our reluctance to learn the lessons from both history and from other countries' current experiences. How can we not learn the lessons emanating from countries like France, the United Kingdom, and Germany? We see a government in France collapsing because it cannot manage its financial affairs. We see German Chancellor Merz warning that the economic powerhouse of Europe, Germany, can no longer afford its welfare state. Some might say that Australia's debt-to-GDP ratio is still much healthier than those countries. But this is to ignore the reality that it is now fast approaching the level at which those countries lost control of their national finances. Our naivety about national debt has, in my mind, been matched by a short-sighted disregard for civil liberties. One aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns was the emergence of a sense that essential freedoms were somehow gifts to be bestowed by government rather than rights inherent to the people. It revealed a troubling nonchalance about the principles of civil liberty that was so hard won in the history of Western liberal democracy and which should not be so easily discarded. We seem to forget that a vital task of democratic government is in fact to restrain its own powers, sometimes against its own interests, even in times of emergency. Distrust and complacency are the two concepts I come back to. Sadly, it seems to me that we are losing trust not only in one another and in the institutions of freedom our forebears bequeathed to us, but, most alarmingly, in the very beliefs and values that gave rise to those institutions in the first place. Perhaps the great American economic historian Thomas Sowell put it best when he reminded us, civilization doesn't sustain itself. It has to be built, maintained, defended, and most importantly, understood. When that understanding is lost, decline is not just likely, it becomes inevitable. And that's the illusion we're living under today, that civilization is permanent, but it isn't. It is rented, and every generation must pay the rent. Right now, we're skipping payments, and the landlord always shows up, eventually. I do not pretend to have the expertise to offer remedies to all the public policy challenges that now confront us. But when it comes to regenerating Australia's democratic spirit, any solution must include relearning our national story. According to the Australian Government's Trust in Democracy survey, less than half of Australians have received some form of civic education. And all too often when young Australians are taught about their country and heritage, it is following a curriculum that has a disproportionate focus on historical injustices, rather than presenting the full complexity of our Australian story. We demean ourselves when we forget or decry those who did so much to establish the principles of freedom and opportunity that we take for granted in this country. There is a better story of Australia, one that includes the injustices, but also shows that seeds of hope were already being planted at an early stage. The first governor of the colony, Arthur Phillip, made clear the year before the establishment of the convict settlement at Botany Bay that there can be no slavery in a free land and consequently no slaves. Practice did not always match principle. Across the 19th century, blackbirding into Queensland's sugar industry, for example, brought tens of thousands of Pacific Islanders, many through coercion or kidnapping. Wages were withheld, Families were separated, and later many were deported under the Pacific Island Labourers Act of 1901. And it is undoubtedly true that Indigenous Australians faced brutal injustice, too often at the hands of too many. The horrific case of the Mile Creek Massacre, to take just one example, was an outrageous barbarity that offends to the very core our fundamental belief in the worth and dignity of every soul. The legal processes that followed Mile Creek represented the best and the worst of Australia at that time. There were the brave men and women who ensured, even in those days of very few police in remote areas, that the perpetrators were arrested. Then there was the jury at the first trial, who shamefully acquitted the perpetrators on a legal technicality in less than 20 minutes. One of the jurors was quoted as saying, "I would never see a white man hanged for killing a black." Then there was the heroism of Attorney General John Plunkett at the time, outraged at the blatant miscarriage of justice. He forced a retrial, and in the second trial, seven men were found guilty of murder and hanged. The better angels from within had at last prevailed in our legal system. Finally, some of the justice promised to Indigenous people was being realised. Yet there are other important stories we need to tell about Indigenous people in this country. I find the extraordinary story of Indigenous woman Maria Yellamundi, Maria Locke as she became, deeply moving. Maria's father, the Darug leader Yellamundi, and Lachlan Macquarie, the governor, became good friends. They agreed that Maria would study at Governor Macquarie's Parramatta Native Institution. In 1819, Maria stunned the colony by taking the first prize in the public examinations, beating almost 100 non-Indigenous children. 5 years later, she married a convict carpenter, Robert Locke, had 10 children, and eventually acquired significant property in her own name. Stories like hers give us a fuller sense of the richness and complexity of our national story, in which there is much to grieve and so much to be proud of. As we relearn our national story, we must also re-establish the importance of personal character in public leadership and also in civility in our public discourse. Our public leaders are not just architects of our policies and stewards of our national story. They are also, in their personal character, representatives of our deepest values and role models for our children. I believe we would all do well to ensure that we do our level best not to give offence and redouble our efforts not to take offence. We must refrain from inflamed accusation of treason or betrayal towards those who think differently. We need to break the re-emergence of this vicious cycle that history tells us has so frequently resulted in misery. We are, after all, proud inheritors of the tradition of His Majesty's loyal opposition, where profound disagreement is expected, even encouraged, without questioning one another's loyalty. The antidote to the coarseness of our current debate, to name-calling and vitriol, is surely to display such civility that those on the other side of the table are compelled to debate the substance of the issues. With the current President of the United States being the man that he is, perhaps there's never been a more important time for other leaders in the Western world to counterbalance that influence with old-fashioned values of civility, integrity, and humility. Renewal of our democratic spirit requires leadership of such character. And perhaps most of all, it requires of us the humility to avoid chronological snobbery. For if we now see some things more clearly than our forebears, we should expect our children to see some things more clearly than us. As C.S. Lewis put it, every age has its own outlook. It is especially good at seeing certain truths and especially liable to making certain mistakes. Menzies, who it must be remembered, was a true intellectual, reminded us that democracy is far more than the tallying of votes. It is a spiritual conviction which for him was rooted in the Christian conception that there is in every human soul a spark of the divine. Similarly, the great Australian historian Manning Clark, while not professing quite the same Christian convictions as Menzies, reflected nonetheless on the deep cultural and spiritual underpinnings of our democracy. He feared that Australia could become a kingdom of nothingness, focused only on short-term material comfort and superficial progress, neglecting deeper cultural and spiritual development to its own demise. I share that fear. Without a deep democratic spirit, democracy is a hollow ritual ready to be blown over by the next strong wind. Yet, I remain profoundly hopeful. In recent years, I've stumbled into the podcasting world, which has brought me unexpectedly into contact with many of our younger generations. What I'm seeing in many of these young people is truly impressive. Their thoughtfulness and longing for a restoration of purpose inspire me. I'm convinced that many of our youth will, with the right encouragement, rise to meet the challenge of leadership, and our earthly hope surely rests with them. And to my fellow older Australians, I make one plea. Let us neither exasperate or demoralise the next generations, even when we feel misunderstood by them. Let us encourage them, equip them to the best of our ability, stand beside them as they carry Australia's democratic spirit forward into whatever struggles lie ahead. The future of democracy, both globally and in Australia, depends on it.
And John Anderson joined me after his lecture to expand on a few points, including why he thinks character is so important to democracy. Our first lecturer spoke about democratic institutions in this country as a basis for our prosperity. That's something that's unique and that we should be proud of. You seem to be saying that we actually really need to look at the spirit of democracy here. Explain to me why you think it's flailing somewhat. People are still turning up to vote. 9 out of 10 Australians are voting, still trust the AEC. We still have fair and fair elections. Our courts have not been corrupted. Why do you think there's a problem there?
Because I think trust is breaking down. You can see that in all the numbers everywhere, in all of our institutions, by the way, not just our parliaments and the players therein. Trust is breaking down. And trust in the institutions is breaking down because they're not understood. The underlying thinking, the agony, really, and the high price and the sacrifice placed by many people to give us the institutions of freedom, the legal systems that guarantee the common law and so forth, they're not understood. And I'm with Thomas Sowell, who's warning that if you don't understand them, in the end, decline becomes inevitable. You have to actually have a comprehension of what stands behind them and how we got them, so that, as David Brooks from the other side of politics in America, if I can put it that way, as he puts it, you can cultivate the garden, you can keep it alive, you can keep it healthy.
Right.
If you ignore it, if you don't prune it, if you don't weed it, in the end, they'll fail.
So complacency is a problem here, and it stops us from being vigilant.
I think complacency is the downside of the characteristics that we all rejoice in Australia. We're not into hierarchies. We're not on ourselves. We think it's important not to take ourselves too seriously. All great things.
Having tickets on yourself, you cannot have.
That's a great thing about Australia. Yeah. We carry it too far sometimes. I think with it has gone complacency. We don't understand what we've been bequeathed and how durable it's been. And how, in the end, because I passionately believe this, I can't believe that the alternatives could ever be anything like as attractive. The way to work yourself through the great issues is through the democratic process. It requires people who will respect the democratic processes and leaders who are worthy of respect as well.
How would you describe the spirit of democracy in America right now?
Deeply divided. There's obviously an incredible battle going on for the soul of America. It's bifurcating geographically as well as in terms of what's happening in local communities. So you're getting red states and blue states that are almost mini nations. And some are doing remarkably well. You know, their economies are strong. Their societies seem to be strong. Others are in appalling state. And the warfare is awful for us all to watch, and we don't know where it's going to land. Mm. In some ways, you could almost say it's French Revolution, which was the Reign of Terror, versus the American Independence Revolution. And Americans are sort of torn between the two, and I'm hoping they end up going back to the American Independence Revolution, because I think it gave us, frankly, a nation that really we've all benefited from. Mm. Not just in countries like Australia. I look at the post-World War II liberal global order, as it's known, and I'm a farmer and I'm very invested in feeding people, research, as well as Australian exports. Look at what we've achieved in our area, in this what was a very troubled area in the 1930s and 40s. The rise in prosperity throughout Asia, the doubling of living standards, of the uptake of education and opportunity and what have you, that's what a coherent global order can look like. But it has been overseen by Americans, frustrating as they might be to us at times, and now they seem to, not only are they being challenged, but they're wondering themselves internally whether they want to take that role on anymore.
Mm. Oh, yeah, wondering very loudly.
Yes.
Internally. It's something else that's been really impacted in the US by some of these divisions you outline is the quality of debate.
Yes.
And many observers speaking about the prevalence of contempt in the way people view their political opponents.
Yep.
Now, you've said as well that debate here, that it's very difficult to have civil debate in this country. What's your evidence for that, and what are the potential consequences?
It's the way in which we attack one another personally. And see, I actually think we ought to have more, not less, disagreement. Mm. We need to do more disagreement, and we probably even need to shout even louder. But the coarseness comes in when it's not about the issues. You're a bad person if you dare to disagree with me. That's what's undoing us. It's a demonisation of people in defiance. This is when I say we've lost understanding of our own culture, our own institutions. The genius at the heart of Western civilization has been the ability to disagree. And the deeper the disagreement, the more important it is that you agree to disagree in a civil way. And the idea of freedom of conscience came out of bloodshed and people slaughtering one another and burning one another at the stake for daring to disagree. Mm. We overthrew that. We came to a compact that was different. And, you can't get away from it. It's based essentially on the Judeo-Christian concept that every individual, Menzies made this point, has about them the spark of the divine, a higher authority, if I can put it that way, not constrained by our human limitations, has said, the person you disagree with still matters. They're just as important as you are, if you like. All souls equal in the eyes of heaven, Menzies said. I don't know how you get by without that, because we all know the anger that wells up inside. How dare you disagree with me? You are a lesser person. You've got to be able to pull yourself up and say, no, I can't say you're a lesser person. But by hell, I'll argue with you about your ideas.
Yes. It's hard to not get sucked into that sometimes.
It's very hard.
Now, one place you've been trying to host some of these civil debates is on your YouTube channel, which at last reckoning, I think it's got about 750,000 subscribers. What have you discovered through broadcasting in that space?
A hunger for content.
Yep.
A hunger for ideas. And the thing that really encourages me, Julia, is a number of younger people who are perhaps not reading, and we decry that. Perhaps they're not listening to mainstream media. Perhaps that's a problem. I don't know. It doesn't mean they're not interested in ideas. They are. Mm. And they pull me up in the streets. This is something I never expected. I want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I've said my great hope, is that so many of those younger people, I think, are saying, hey, we're being sold a bit of a pup here and we shouldn't buy it.
What's the pup?
Well, the pup is poor thinking. It's coarseness. It's if you dare to disagree with the zeitgeist, there's something wrong with you. Mm. We used to say question everything in schools. Now we say, you dare to question the orthodoxy to our young people and you're a lesser person. And that's where a lot of the incivilities start coming from, in my view.
And so when you say they pull you up, what do they want to talk about exactly? Just the nature of debate?
They're pretty despairing about the outlook. There's a whole range of things that they're being told are, great challenges, and we all know what they are. Not least is how on earth do we get a start? They're very conscious that they're not going to get the economic opportunities that we got. And that particularly comes home with the idea of homes. I had a young fellow the other day say of one of his best friends, he's gone over to the dark side. He's managed to get the deposit ready for a house. Don't know how he did it. And I don't know how I'm going to do it.
The dark side.
The dark. Yeah. It was just an expression.
Yeah.
But he was making a point.
Yeah.
How did we get to the stage in Australia where 60% of young people don't think they'll ever own a home unless they inherit? And what unhealthy dynamics does that set up? Mm. And what does it do to family formation? What does it do to relationships?
What does it do to democracy?
What does it do to democracy? Well, it means you're not invested in the system. Mm. You know, you think it's not delivering for you. Delivered for my parents, it's not delivering for me. Mm. And, you know, then, of course, we've compiled that problem. We're making it much worse mm. by building up debts because we won't live within our means. Mm.
Now, speaking of remarkable qualities, one thing that you highlighted in your lecture was character. And you said that with the current president of the United States being the man that he is, perhaps there's never been a more important time for other leaders in the Western world to counterbalance that influence with old-fashioned values of civility, integrity, and humility. How would you describe the character of the president of the United States?
I don't think he'd want a character readout from me. I'd just say that he's obviously a massively forceful personality and I'm all for him having tough debates, but I don't like them personalised. And I think particularly in the Australian context, what Australians are very astute at picking up is who you're there for. Are you there for them? Is your approach one of service? Or is it one of lording it over others? And so for Australia, I think it's really important we recognise that people don't mind a vigorous debate. I actually think we should have more debate, more disagreement, but it ought to be vastly less personalised. Mm.
So the problem that's happened in the United States, you're saying, with Donald Trump's particular style has been about being critical, very critical of opponents, and that's affected the way we the broader political discourse in the US.
Really important to draw the distinction here. I have no problem with him being critical of different ideas. Mm. But when it has tones of contempt for the person putting the different view, mm. I think that is problematic. I don't think that helps take the debate forward, our society forward, reunifying around the things that should be pulling us together.
But do you think that has influenced the way we talk to each other here?
Oh, I in many ways, I think Trump is more the product of the problem than the cause of it. I really do. I think we have fallen badly in the name of identity politics into self-righteousness and accusing others of being lesser people if they disagree with our view of the world.
So if we were to do what you said, and which is to focus on character in Australian political life, what would that look like?
It would mean a palpable and obvious engagement with the issues. Take housing. We all know there's a housing crisis. We know that all three levels of government have a major role to play in sorting the problem out. So where's the character? Where's the commitment to service? Where's the commitment to the future, which is we always say is our children, in tackling the problem openly and honestly and with some intellectual rigour?
So then why is character important to a democracy, character in its leaders especially?
Because you have to be able to trust your leaders. A democracy won't work when trust breaks down. You know, you end up with authoritarian regimes enforcing government decrees, if you like, rather than building them with consensus on the basis of trust and drawing people together, winning the argument on its merits. Trust breaks down when people feel that their leaders don't have their best interests at heart. And when trust breaks down, you've got a problem. People don't believe they're being led by people of character.
That was John Anderson, sixth-generation farmer, grazier and former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. Please tune in at the same time next week on ABC Radio National for our third lecture from distinguished Professor Larissa Berendt, and it's a fascinating one. Deeply entrenched in the legal history of this country, she presents an authoritative outline of the great strengths of our laws and constitution which have upheld our democracy, as well as the pitfalls. Her lecture offers Australians a hopeful glimpse of the great possibilities on offer if we have the courage to draw on ancient wisdoms. So tune in to Radio National's Sunday Extra next week. And don't forget, you can also watch the Boyer Lectures on the ABC News Channel on iView. I'm Julia Baird. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.